From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the White House says the US would consider the use of troops in a humanitarian effort to help refugees in northern Iraq, but insists US soldiers aren't going to war.
We have a very specific objective with respect to the humanitarian situation. That is to get food, water, and emergency supplies to the population on this mountain.
Also today, our reporter is in South Sudan, where the UN is trying to persuade political leaders to reach a peace deal to end 8 months of fighting. And tragedy in Brazil, as a presidential candidate is among those killed in a Sao Paulo state plane crash.
Plane crashed into a residential area on its way to landing. So Brazil now is in mourning, and there's a lot of speculation about what this might mean for the presidential election.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. France is set to supply arms to the Kurds in northern Iraq after approval for the move from Baghdad. Meanwhile, UK Prime Minister David Cameron has cut short his holiday to address the Iraq crisis and says Britain will play a role in plans for an international mission to rescue stranded Yazidis at Mount Sinjar. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
France says the catastrophic situation faced by the population of Kurdistan means it's necessary to support Peshmerga forces fighting IS militants in northern Iraq. Its move follows supplies of weapons to the Kurds by the US, with Washington also boosting its military advisers in the Kurdistan region. British Prime Minister David Cameron's returned home early to chair an emergency meeting on Iraq. But while the UK's focus remains on humanitarian efforts, Mr. Cameron does say detailed plans are coming together for an international mission to rescue people from the Yazidi minority stranded at Mount Sinjar, with Kurdish officials warning of a looming genocide at the hands of IS militants.
Meanwhile, the United States is scrambling to assist in the rescue of thousands of Iraqi Kurds still stranded on Mount Sinjar, surrounded by Islamic militants. The U.S. has upped the number of military advisers who have arrived in the regional Kurdish capital of Erbil. Washington insists the 130 Marines and Special Forces will not be engaged in combat, and the White House has repeated that there is no specific plan yet on how to rescue the trapped Kurds. But President Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes signaled there were a number of ways the military task force could help create a safe passage for those trapped, prompting questions over whether they would return fire.
What he's ruled out is reintroducing U.S. forces into combat on the ground in Iraq. But there are a variety of ways in which we can support the safe removal of those people from the mountain. And frankly, we already have people on the ground working with Kurdish forces in a joint operations center in Erbil.
The United Nations says the death toll in Ukraine has doubled in the last 2 weeks to at least 2,086 casualties, in what it describes as a clear escalating trend. Meanwhile, a Russian convoy carrying aid for East Ukraine has been stalled amidst a row with Kiev over whether it can cross the border into the country. Some 300 trucks taking humanitarian aid to the conflict zone in East Ukraine have been stopped near Voronezh, some 300 kilometers from the border point. The Ukrainian government has denied the convoy permission to cross the border, with the country's deputy foreign minister slamming the humanitarian aid as an act of Russian cynicism.
Let me be clear. You don't need tanks and artillery to bring food and medicine for civilians.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. In Africa, about 45 women and children who were abducted by the rebel group the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, have emerged from captivity. The group surrendered themselves to the Democratic Republic of Congo Army in a small town called Digba in the northeast of the country. Our Africa correspondent Isabel Nakiria reports.
The returnees, all women and children, will be handed over to the African Union forces in Obor in the Central African Republic. The emergency of the group is the biggest defection since Ugandan forces started the hunt for the LRA in 2012, which is led by Joseph Kony. The Ugandan army says it signals the LRA is defeated. Analysts say this is a hopeful sign that the authorities are a step closer to dismantling the Lord's Resistance rebel group completely. I'm Isabel Nakiria in Kampala.
And Pope Francis has begun his first trip to Asia, flying to South Korea in a journey aimed at building links between the papacy and the world's most populous continent, where just 3% of the world's Catholics live. It's his third trip abroad since becoming pope, following Brazil in July 2013 and Israel and Palestine last May. Elena Casas reports from Rome.
Pope Francis is spending 5 days in South Korea, where Catholicism has grown from 2% of the population to 11% in just a couple of decades. But this visit could have diplomatic impact. Chinese Catholics have been invited, as the church hopes to bridge the gap with China, which does not have diplomatic relations with the Vatican. It's the first of 3 trips he has planned around Asia, aiming to raise awareness of the church in the world's most populous continent. He's set to visit Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and possibly Japan in January.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I think the principle holds that we're not putting ground forces into a combat role in Iraq. We're using U.S. military personnel to assess what the best way is to bring people to safety and what the best way is to provide them with humanitarian assistance. But again, always, force protection is a mission for U.S. personnel wherever they are in the world. That's certainly true of the reinforcements that are protecting our facilities in Erbil and Baghdad.
White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes saying the U.S. would consider the use of troops in a humanitarian effort to help refugees in northern Iraq, but was adamant that such a mission wouldn't represent a U.S. role in the fight against so-called Islamic State militants. The United States has already increased its military presence in the country's north with an additional 130 advisers sent to the Kurdish city of Erbil. As fighting continues, the United Nations called for more international assistance to help the hundreds of thousands displaced by the extremist surge, with special focus on the plight of those trapped on the Sinjar Mountain without food, water or medical supplies. Jana Mason is a senior advisor for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and explained just how harrowing the situation for these civilians had become.
What we believe at this point is that since the most recent ISIS offensive in early August, that at least 200,000 people, mostly Yazidis and Christians and other minorities in the Sinjar region, have been displaced. These are internally displaced persons, as we call them. We know that since the beginning of this year, 2014, if you include the 200,000 plus over 600,000 displaced, largely from Mosul, that there have been somewhere in the vicinity of 1.2 million Iraqis internally displaced this year alone. You add that to hundreds of thousands who were already long displaced by the Iraq war and the violence there in the past decade, and you could have over 2 million internally displaced persons. But the most recent violence has probably affected at least 200,000 people.
Let's just go back to Mount Sinjar in particular, because it's been a focal point of the crisis over the weeks. Can you give us an idea of the conditions and the situation that these civilians who have literally been fleeing for their lives are coming up against? And how the aid operation so far is strategically working to help them?
I haven't been to the mountain, but from reports that I've read, it is incredibly barren and inhospitable in terms of sustaining life for any length of time. I've been told it's something like 100 kilometers long and 10 kilometers wide, and temperatures can reach 45 Celsius, 110 Fahrenheit. I've read, according to one of our UN partners, UNICEF, mm-hmm. that roughly half of the people who have been displaced recently are children under 15. Now, it's not unusual in any displacement crises for there to be a lot of children. Usually women and children are largely affected. But to have half of them children 15 or under shows that this is this population is a little bit younger than maybe some other uprooted populations. And therefore, I think it would be fair to say that in many ways this is a children's displacement crisis. I'm sure that the people on the mountain, by all reports, have been desperate and the airdrops have been the only thing keeping some of them alive and allowing some of them to escape or to be evacuated with assistance off the mountain. For those who are still there, the food drops, the drops of water, presumably are still helping them keep alive, stay alive. Hopefully it will be enough to allow all of them to eventually evacuate from the mountain.
Can you explain to us what the circumstances are, the form of persecution that is putting these people in this impossible situation where they seem to be exchanging, you know, potential death for these harrowing conditions?
Yeah, the Yazidis are a religious minority in Iraq. As we also are aware, Christians and other religious and ethnic minorities are being targeted by the Islamic State as well. So this is clearly persecution on the basis of religion or on the basis of ethnic background. Both of those under international refugee law would qualify someone as a refugee. These people, again, if they're still in Iraq, they're not technically refugees because they haven't crossed an international border. They're internally displaced persons in Iraq, but they're fleeing the same type of persecution, particularly on the basis of religion or ethnic background, the same type of persecution that makes them refugees if they cross the border. And so, for example, those 10 to 15,000 that have stayed on the Syria side are now refugees in Syria, just like there are Syrian refugees in Iraq who have also fled either religious persecution, ethnic persecution, or political opinion. But I think the actual box you put the persecution in is probably less relevant now to the fact that they're in daily danger, particularly the ones that have not yet found safety in the Kurdistan region. They're in danger. Their lives are at risk. Their safety is at risk. Certainly for those 100,000 or more who were children, the situation is particularly dire.
The United States is sending out approximately 130 military advisors in a humanitarian capacity. Do you have any idea of what sort of role they'll be taking, or if you don't, what direction they perhaps should be taking over the crisis?
Well, I think I can say with confidence that the only thing ultimately that will bring this humanitarian situation, allow it to be resolved, is a political solution. I know a White House spokesman recently made the comment that there's no military solution to this conflict. What we in the humanitarian field often say is that there are no humanitarian solutions to displacement crises and refugee crises, meaning that the humanitarian community works very hard to keep people alive and fed and sheltered and protected and healthy while they're in conflict and while they're uprooted from their homes. But ultimately, a political solution needs to be found. So whatever efforts can be taken to bring about that solution in Iraq so that this most recent wave of displacement can be resolved, but also so that the 2 million or so people displaced around Iraq, so that these people can eventually go home and not fear for their lives.
Jana Mason, Senior Advisor for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Now, the European Union has confirmed the arming of Iraqi Kurds will remain at the discretion of each member country, France being the first EU state to begin sending weapons to Erbil in the fight against jihadist militants from the so-called Islamic State. Meanwhile, the EU is preparing emergency talks to discuss the worsening security crisis in Iraq on Friday. Our correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
After receiving a green light from the EU, France is now the first European country to send arms to Kurdish forces fighting jihadist militants from the Islamic State, making advances into northern Iraq. During a meeting of EU ambassadors in the Political and Security Committee in Brussels, it was decided the EU's current policy makes it legal for individual member states to grant weapons licenses to Iraq, despite the EU's arms embargo there. EU foreign policy spokesman Sebastian Brabant.
Member states can supply arms and related material to Iraq consistent with their obligations under these two common positions and the applicable resolutions of the Security Council. And we also noted that the Iraqi government itself has provided arms and ammunition to the Kurdish regional government.
France's decision follows action already taken by the U.S. to provide weapons to Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. But the position of other European countries remains unclear. Italy says it's in favor of sending arms, but Germany is examining non-lethal options like sending transport and communication equipment. It makes the prospect of achieving a joint EU position on Iraq quite difficult, despite best efforts to call an emergency meeting among foreign ministers this Friday. But regional players like Turkey, a country which would have traditionally been against arming its Kurdish neighbors, may have a new interest in doing so, according to Amanda Paul, an analyst from the European Policy Center.
If the Kurds aren't armed, if they're not supported, it means you'll be bringing the ISIS conflict to Turkey, basically the border between Turkey and Iraq, which would be a serious problem for Turkey's national security. So I don't think that Turkey has any concerns about the consequences of arming the Kurds.
Meanwhile, northern Iraq's humanitarian crisis continues to deepen. The UK and France have been airlifting basic supplies like water and tents to remote areas. The European Union also boosted its funding from 12 to 17 million euro. But international charities like Oxfam say the help so far has come too late and has not been enough to help the more than 1.2 million displaced people in northern Iraq. Sarah Tesorieri.
The Kurdish government's done a lot. The local NGOs and local organizations are doing a lot. They need more international support. There is a need for more money. The UN's appeal on Iraq is not remotely fully funded. So given the level of disaster we're facing, the current levels are not sufficient. Airdrops are a means of last resort. Obviously, we had a situation in a certain area on the mountaintop where the Yazidis were trapped, where that was the only option for a certain period, but it absolutely is not the best option. We do need better access.
But securing the delivery of aid will require fighting to stop. And with fresh arms from the West now flowing into the hands of the Kurdish Peshmerga, the battles against IS militants are only set to intensify, with many more fleeing the violence. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
This is FSN Reports. A Trojan horse. That's how Ukraine's deputy foreign minister has dubbed the delivery of a convoy of humanitarian aid from Russia to eastern Ukraine. The Kiev-based government has said it will reject the delivery, which is arriving via hundreds of Russian trucks. Controversy and suspicions surrounding the convoy appears to be growing the closer to the border it gets. Our Russia correspondent, Tom Barton.
After a day rife with speculation about the progress of a Russian aid convoy that Moscow said was carrying humanitarian supplies to civilians in the east of Ukraine, those hundreds of trucks have moved nowhere. The white lines in the background behind me are those trucks at a military air base in the Russian city of Voronezh, not far from the Ukrainian border. They had planned to move on to a checkpoint on the border, but as Russian media reported, it is possible that a disagreement between Ukraine and Russia about the method and the modus operandi of that movement of the trucks broke down, and so the trucks ended up not going that extra stage in their journey. Russia has said that this humanitarian convoy has to get through to civilians in the east of Ukraine trapped in the crossfire between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian rebels there. They say it contains things including baby food, electricity generators and medicine. Ukraine has rejected that, some MPs in Ukraine's parliament calling it a Trojan horse and accusations that it may be trying to smuggle weapons to pro-Russian rebels there, or potentially be used as a pretext by Russia to start a military intervention in east of Ukraine. Russia has rejected that as absurd, despite Western warnings that it should not try such a thing. There is one thing that is not in doubt about the journey of this convoy that has been subject to so much rumour throughout the day, and that is that the region it is intended for is not a peaceful one.
Our Russia correspondent, Tom Barton. Brazilian presidential candidate Eduardo Campos has been killed along with six other passengers in a plane crash in the southeast of the country.
There were no survivors. The small aircraft reportedly went down in a residential area in the port city of Santos. Jonathan Watts is the Latin America correspondent for The Guardian.
We now have confirmation that the presidential candidate Eduardo Campos has been killed, along with every other person on the Cessna plane that he was aboard in between campaign stops. He was close to Sao Paulo in a place called Santos, and according to the local fire brigade, the weather conditions were bad and the plane crashed into a residential area on its way to landing. So Brazil now is in mourning, and there's a lot of speculation about what this might mean for the presidential election, which is due to take place on the 5th of October.
So in your opinion, just to add to that speculation, what could this mean for that presidential election?
I think, well, in the short term, the focus is going to be on remembering this tragedy and marking it properly. And President Dilma Rousseff has announced 3 days of official mourning, so there won't be any campaigning for the next 3 days. And then after that, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what will happen to the party, the Socialist Party of Mr. Campos. He obviously was the candidate, but he had a very high-profile and controversial running mate, Marina Silva, who is Brazil's most famous environmental campaigner. She's a very powerful figure, a very divisive figure, particularly many people in the rural sector, the farming sector, dislike her. But she could very well now step to the fore and be the main candidate. Marina Silva has proved a powerful figure in the past. She was the candidate who eventually made it to a runoff with Dilma Rousseff in the last presidential election in 2010. Although she was convincingly beaten at the time. So all eyes will now be on that. And in addition, I think it will be interesting to see whether there's a sympathy vote and whether this affects the polls for the other two candidates. There are three presidential candidates, the president, Dilma Rousseff, her main challenger, and Eduardo Campos. So now it's going to go down. The field will be, in a sense, revised, and it will be interesting to see whether the Socialist Party, which is currently third, makes a gain or what happens. But anyway, the whole process is at the moment, has at the moment been thrown into disarray by this tragedy today.
Can you tell us a little bit about the man? What sort of politician was Eduardo Campos, and what sort of campaign was he running?
Eduardo Campos is a blue blood politician from the northeast. He's born in Recife and is the grandson of Miguel Arreaz, who was also the governor of Pernambuco. And spent 15 years in exile during the military dictatorship. And his grandfather was indeed seen as a figurehead of the pro-democracy movement. And the young Campos was behind him from a very early age and really cut his teeth in his early 20s. He later served as the youngest minister in the first government of President Lula in 2005. And since then, he's twice been governor of Pernambuco State, which is one of the poorest states in Brazil. But during his time in office, the economy grew faster than the national average. And he's considered very pragmatic, relatively pro-business for a socialist candidate. And if anything, I suppose the criticism of him is that he seems to appeal to everybody, which works very well in Pernambuco. When he left office, he had approval ratings of well over 80%. But in this current election, he had been lacking focus, perhaps, and he and Marina Silva were in third place with about 10% of national support. So all in all, sort of a well-thought-of politician, very popular in his home base, who was trying to make his mark on the national stage. Probably wouldn't have won this time round, but was definitely seen as one of the rising stars of his generation. Politicians of all stripes have lined up to express their condolences and say what a loss this is for Brazil's politics.
Jonathan Watts, Latin America correspondent for The Guardian. Now, the United Nations is visiting South Sudan to persuade political leaders to reach a peace agreement to end 8 months of fighting. Thousands have died and more than 1.5 million people have been displaced. With the country now facing famine, finding a peaceful future for the world's newest nation is more urgent than ever. Nick Harper reports from South Sudan's capital, Juba.
By visiting South Sudan to meet its president Salva Kiir face to face, the United Nations Security Council was sending a strong message that the fighting has to stop. US representative to the UN Ambassador Samantha Power was leading the charge.
This Security Council visit comes in a way as an emergency visit to this country to underscore to the leadership here just how important it is to follow through on the commitments made, to put together a transitional governing body in the run-up to elections.
But diplomats said that Kiir had given them little reassurance of any progress in their closed-door meeting. So the president of the Security Council, the UK's ambassador Mark Lyle Grant, reiterated a threat of consequences if the fighting did not cease.
The Security Council expresses its readiness to consider all appropriate measures, including targeted sanctions, against those who take action that undermines the peace, stability and security of South Sudan.
Last December, fighting erupted after an alleged coup by Vice President Riek Machar. Since then, ethnic conflict has engulfed the country, with thousands killed. And ceasefires agreed since then have been repeatedly broken. Rwanda's ambassador, Eugene Gasana, said peace must come through peaceful means.
We totally agreed with what the president just told us, that the only solution is the dialogue, good, well, political dialogue. And the parties must know that the people of South Sudan have suffered enough.
The Security Council also met with officials from the UN's mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS. They heard the grave warning that despite a lull in violence, UNMISS believes warring factions are using the rainy season as a time to rearm and regroup. And then to the north of the country, to the UN compound in Malakal, where 18,000 civilians have sought shelter from the fighting. The rainy season there has flooded the temporary shelters, leaving families who've already lost everything even more desperate than before. Colonel Ivor Hoff has been in charge of the UN peacekeepers in Malakal since early January and admits these are some of the hardest conditions he's ever seen.
It's been a challenging environment, I must admit. I've been to several hotspot areas before, but those have been more kind of organized. This was very unorganized, and it's been a very harsh condition, and it's been very tough for my team to survive.
Creating a new country from scratch was surely never going to be easy. But 3 years on from independence, and there's a real sense of not just disappointment, but frustration and anger that things have gone so badly wrong. With the government and the opposition no nearer creating a transitional government, the path to peace still seems full of obstacles. Nick Harper, Juba.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us reports@featurestory.com and you can follow us on Twitter @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone, with Feature Story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.